drastically, really, from the normal procedure. And also, I'm going to deviate from my normal method of presentation. And we're going to discuss the subject that we began investigating about 2 weeks ago. Is there a God? 2 weeks ago tonight, we noticed some reasons why people believe there is no God. We purposely stated it like that because taking the position that there is no God is a matter of faith, just like taking the position that there is God is a matter of faith. We gave three reasons that are commonly given by men on the street, common ordinary men and women, reasons that they feel justify their believing that there is no God. One of these reasons is, I cannot see him, therefore I don't believe that he exists. But we notice that there are many things that we cannot see that we believe exist anyway. Radio and television signals, germs or microscopic organisms that cannot be seen with the naked eye, things that are actually invisible, many things that we cannot see or that we have not seen, and yet we believe anyway they exist. A second reason that we noticed, someone says, I cannot conceive of a God of love and power allowing the suffering that's in the world today to exist unchecked. But we also observe that God is not the origin of these things, and that he allows some things to exist that he does not necessarily condone. And that to take away suffering in a world filled with sin is about like a father taking away the sense of feel in a little child of his and putting him in a room filled with hot stoves. That the suffering and the consequences of sin serve as a natural deterrent to sin. Sin is the cause of the suffering, not God. Then we noticed a third reason that people give for believing that there is no God, and that is, I feel no need for God. But we noticed that probably more than feeling no need for God is that they feel that they do not wish to assume responsibility to answer for a God or answer to a God. So these three reasons were given and answered, I think, honestly and, I believe, truthfully. I attempted to do it in a way that would not show or cast any reflection upon someone who might hold these positions. I don't want to make fun of or make light of anyone's disbelief. It's very serious. And I offered these things in all good conscience, believing that they do not hold water. They will not stand up in a court. So I think we saw that these three reasons were really, in essence, unreasonable. We tested each one of them individually and fairly. Plus, whenever you put atheism to the test of practicality or to the test of the pragmatic, that is, does it work, you find that atheism just doesn't work. The indictment against atheism is written down in the holy record of the Bible in Ephesians, the second chapter, when the Apostle Paul reminded the Hebrew or the Ephesian people of their prior existence before they became believers. And he told them, I want you to remember that you were at that time separate from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. I believe that the two key words in this category or this catalog of the world's ills, I believe the two key words there are the words no hope. No hope. No hope. And I maintain, and we'll notice conversely in just a few moments, but I maintain that man cannot live without hope. And I believe atheism to be a system of faith that breeds not hope, but hopelessness. It breeds despair and pessimism. Now, if there's anyone here tonight who thinks otherwise, we'll be more than happy for you to speak what you would like to say. If you feel that atheism breeds hope, then we'll be more than happy for you to speak out and say so. And I know that that perhaps might put you on the spot. If you'd like to talk with me afterwards, then I'll be more than happy to talk with you and listen as long as you'd like to talk. And I offer that as a sincere offer tonight. But in this Ephesian letter, chapter 2 and verse 12, the key to the pragmatic test against atheism, when you put atheism to the pragmatism test, it simply comes out lacking. It comes out with this one great indictment against it: atheism breeds no hope. It breeds hopelessness. But tonight, I want to begin sharing with you, because I'm going to be talking about it for the next several Sunday nights. I want to be sharing with you some reasons why I believe that there is God. I want to take these and subject them, these reasons, to the same tests that we subjected atheism. I want to subject this position of belief to the pragmatic test. Does it work? I want to subject this position of belief to the logical test. Does it make sense? And I think, well, let me not say what I think. These are the two tests I want to put the subject of belief to. Does it make sense? And does it work? Then I want to illustrate it tonight. And then I want to call upon some interesting sources for comments and for quotations. And then I want to ask you to draw a conclusion based upon the evidence that's been presented tonight. This particular method of presentation, as I say, is quite a deviation from what I'm accustomed to, but I believe it's important that we approach it this way tonight. I want to discuss with you, first of all, and I want you to hang with me and see if you can understand what I'm saying. Usually, if you don't, it means that the man that is saying it really doesn't understand it himself. It's an indictment on the speaker, so listen and make sure that you understand what I'm saying. Two things I want to bring to your attention tonight: evidence from pragmatics and from logic. Simon Peter, bless his heart, though he was not a highly educated man, due to his association with Jesus Christ and under the tutelage of Jesus and under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, Simon Peter brought together in one very magnificent verse in 1 Peter 3:15 both of these subjects, when he said that we ought to be ready to give an answer to everyone that asks a reason for the hope that lies within you, yet with meekness and fear. But Peter uses both of these words that I want to use tonight. One of them is the subject is the test of pragmatics. The other is the test of logic. Reason for the hope that lies within you. First of all, notice the test of pragmatics. This thing of hope. Simon Peter said you ought to give a reason for the hope that lies within you. I think you and I would have to know the background of the people of the first century in order to really understand the impact of this question, or that this the impact of this charge that Peter gave these New Testament Christians. If we could see the hopelessness of the first century, if I could quote to you, and I lost the book and I can't quote it, but a man by the name of Schoenfield, a Jew from England, wrote a book of New Testament times and described in the language, almost identical language, of the Old Testament prophets, who predicted that the days would come when the people would be saying in the morning, "Oh, I wish it were night." And in the nighttime, they'd be saying, "Oh, I wish it were in the morning." Schoenfield says that at the time of the coming of Christ, that people were fainting, they were having tremors, that men were blacking out, that they were in such a fright and fearful state that they could not operate as rational human beings. And he documents this with a whole host of documentation, showing us that the people of the time of Jesus Christ, just prior to his coming, were a people that were plagued and shot through with this hopelessness that so afflicted that pre-Christian era. And I think in order to understand what Peter meant and the impact of it upon his hearers, we would have to understand the hopeless situation of the first century. When Peter said, "Be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within you," I think he was saying that what you possess as an ordinary Christian is very unordinary. What you have in the form of hope is something so strikingly out of the ordinary that people are going to be coming up and asking you, would you please tell me, why is it that you have this hope that you have? I don't have any hope. Why do you have any hope? And Peter said, you be ready when they ask you that question. So whenever they were asked, they were to be able to say, here's the reason why I have this hope within me. But I want to ask a question tonight. Is hope all that important? Now let me differentiate tonight, just briefly, between hope ultimate and just plain old hope. I'm not going to be talking too much about hope ultimate tonight, and yet that's what the subject is. That's what the whole sermon is, I guess. But actually, I'm not going to deal in it because I don't have any way of really testing that. At least I'm not prepared tonight to test it like that. But I am prepared to deal with things in hope in general. Such a, for example, like this. Our economy right now is a bit sick. When you go home tonight and on the 10 o'clock news, he's going to tell you again how many more points the Dow Jones average has drooped in the last, over the weekend, or I haven't even been open during the weekend, but he's going to tell you what happened by whenever they closed Friday afternoon. And the Dow Jones average has dipped to a new low. You know why? Because at this present time, there is not reasonable enough hope of a reasonable return to justify anyone making a very large investment in anything. Whenever President Ford was brought into office, whenever he was inaugurated, what happened to the Dow Jones average? It went up. You know why? Because the people's hope went up. Whenever it appeared that he didn't have any more answers than Kennedy had, here went the Dow Jones average again. You know what it reflected? Hopelessness. I maintain that every facet of the human life is tenable and is tenable only because of the fact that hope exists there. Let me give you some quotations. I asked some of our doctors around. I asked Dr. Formby, what place does hope play in the life of a person in regard to his physical existence? How important is hope to a man's physical well-being? Well, after finding out what I was after, Dr. Formby made this statement. It is a known fact that a depressed person does not recover as rapidly as a person who is in good spirits. And I said, do you mean by depressed person a person who has no hope of getting well? He said, yes, a depressed person, one who's without hope, whose hope has vanished, he doesn't recover nearly as well as the person who is in good spirits and he's got hopes of getting well. Well, you know that. Just as well as you know about the economics, you know that you don't invest in something you don't have a reasonable hope of return. You know also that a person who is physically ill does not recover very well at all unless he has hope of recovering. Do you realize that you can actually will yourself to die? You can so resign yourself to death that you can actually die because you have no hope of getting well. Dr. Jack Thomas, who is also on the campus of Harding College in the psychology department, he's one of our counselors, he made the statement, the major point at which a person becomes suicidal is that point at which he loses hope, the point at which he sees there is no way out. That's true. If you were to go and ask a man standing on top of a 10-story building, why are you jumping? Why are you trying to kill yourself? He would answer you 99 times out of 100, there's no hope. I don't see any way out. That's why I'm killing myself. Dr. Jack Thomas was right. Life on the emotional, psychological level becomes impossible whenever hope is gone. Life on the physical level becomes untenable and it becomes impossible. I guess you'd say better. It becomes really unlikely that a person will continue his physical life or can even recover from physical illness where there's no hope. Another thing, there's a man by the name of Dr. Viktor E. Frankl who wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning, and in it he reveals something about hope as it relates to a person's psychological well-being. In fact, and in Simon Peter's first letter, chapter, this verse that I quoted a moment ago, verse 15 of chapter 3, Peter uses this word, and I'm going to use it, and I'll explain why I'm using it right here. We're talking about hope as being one of the practicalities that life cannot exist without. Life cannot continue without. Peter says, I want you to give a reason for that hope. But the word that Peter uses for reason is the word logos. He said, I want you to give some logic. We get our word logic from this word logos. It has to do with meaning. It has to do with purpose or meaning. And Peter says, I want you to give logic for the hope that lies within you. Peter brings together in this one verse two things that are interwoven so closely that it's hard to separate between them. Peter says that this reason or logic for the hope is brought together, really, not only in 1 Peter 3:15, it's brought together in this little book, Man's Search for Meaning. And this man, Dr. Frankl, is the father of a whole new branch of psychology called logotherapy. And it's taken from the same word, logos, that Simon Peter uses in 1 Peter 3:21, which simply says that man's life without any real meaning has no way of continuing. And I want to take some quotation from it. On page 115, listen to this. He was a Jew, this man was. He spent years in a Nazi prison camp. His mother, his father, his wife, and his children were all slaughtered by the Nazis during their conquest, I think, of Poland. I'm not sure exactly what country. But nevertheless, he had all of his family, his mother, father, wife, and children taken away from him. They were destroyed, put in the gas chambers. He was stripped naked, reduced to the very lowest form of human existence. He finally lived through it, and then he explained what it was that brought him through. You've got to listen to a man like that. Listen to what he says. Any attempt at fighting the camp, that is the concentration camp's psychopathological influence on the prisoner by psychotherapeutic or psychohygienic methods had to aim at giving him inner strength by pointing out to him a future goal to which he could look forward. Instinctively, some of the prisoners attempted to find one on their own. It is a peculiarity of man, listen now, it is a peculiarity of man that he can live only by looking to the future. Again, in page 117, he says, the prisoner who had lost faith in the future, his future, was doomed. With his loss of belief in the future, he also lost his spiritual hold. He let himself decline and became subject to mental and physical decay. Page 110 says, psychological observations of the prisoners have shown that only the men who allowed their inner hold on their moral and spiritual selves to subside eventually fell victim to the camp's degenerating influences. In other words, only the people who lost hope fell victim to the camp's degenerating influences. The ones who held on to their hope were not affected by the demoralizing influence of the concentration camps. On page 121, he makes another observation that I think is worth reading. As we said before, any attempt to restore man's inner strength in the camp had first to succeed in showing him some future goal. Now, that's simply enough to say that without hope, without some belief that there was something ahead of you, that there was some purpose, that there was some hope of getting out, that there was some reason for getting out, without this hope, he said there was not a show, there was no hope for these men succeeding or surviving. Now, there are many other quotations that I could give you, but I quote those to you to give you some idea. And I could say, I don't know what other areas could we go into? There's the, about the money, our national monetary system, our economics. There's physical well-being, there's psychological or mental and emotional well-being. Just in any number, any facet of the human existence, none of those facets can exist and do well without there being hope. And I think you understand that. I think you realize it. My claim tonight is that it is belief in God that is the ultimate hope, and that belief in atheism is the ultimate loss of hope. That's what the Bible says in Ephesians 2:12 and in 1 Peter 3:15. This is what history says. History shows you that faith in God is the ultimate basis of hope, and that faith in no God is the final outcome, or is the final basis of a final outcome of hopelessness. So I maintain tonight that when Simon Peter says, give reason for the hope that's in you, he was pointing to a pragmatic test to which the world has subjected Christianity for 2,000 years. It is a known fact that those who are practicing Christians live and die with hope. It is a known fact that those who practice atheism live and die without any hope. And I don't think there's a person here who would object to that. and I would not object to anybody in the world taking issue with it. I don't think they'll take issue with it. But a second thing, Peter mentions you ought to give a reason for the hope that lies within you. And I'm going to use the word reason here in a bit different way, and yet it's very reasonable and it's very legitimate. He just simply says, give reason for the hope. Give some logic for it. And I maintain this, that belief in God is the most logical explanation that there is of the universe and all that's in it. It's the most reasonable explanation. Can you think of a more reasonable one than that? Well, science is right when they say that something can't come from nothing. Everything you see and everything you are came from something. And when science keeps pushing us and saying that everything comes from something, I say you're right. And science has done us a great service in making clear that something cannot come from nothing. It has to come from something. But you know, there are only two alternatives. Either everything that you see and everything that you are came from matter. Either matter is eternal, and I mean by matter, rocks and mud. Either that is eternal. When I say rocks and mud, we're talking about inanimate and unintelligent matter. Rocks don't talk, except archaeologically. Mud doesn't mourn, though your name may be mud and you may be mourning, but I'm simply saying that these things are inanimate and they are unintelligent. All right, either everything that you are and everything that you see came from matter, mud and rocks, and that's what's eternal. Or else, spirit is eternal. Either matter is eternal, and everything that we see and everything that we are came from matter, or else an intelligent, all-powerful, and loving spirit is eternal. And everything that we see and all that we are came from that spirit. Now, those are the only two alternatives. Is there any other alternative that you can think of? Well, I can't. These are the two basic alternatives from which all that we see and all that we are must have come. But if matter is eternal, something has to be answered. These questions have to be answered. If matter, that is, if inanimate, unintelligent matter is eternal, and all that we see and are has come from that, answer me this. How did motionless matter get into motion? Here's matter. This is some matter here. It's lying there. Unless I or someone else or some force, an earthquake or something, knocks that thing, it'll be here till doomsday. Somebody will have to come move it. It's not going to move itself. How did motionless matter get into motion? But another question, how did matter in motion become intelligent, or how did it become life? How did it become living? For example, that book is matter in motion. But who would say that it has life? There's no life in it. Is there? Matter, motionless matter, how did it get into motion? What changed the motion or the matter in motion into life? What made the matter in motion, if it became life, what made that life intelligent? There's a lot of life that's in the world that's not intelligent. And then how did that intelligence develop a moral consciousness? These are questions that you've got to answer. You can't just say all of this came from lifeless, inanimate, unintelligent matter. Something had to get it into motion. Something had to change it into life. Something had to change it into moral consciousness. See, all of this has to be answered. What is the answer? Well, atheism has no answer. I believe the only intelligent, reasonable answer to life, matter in motion, moral consciousness, and all these other attributes of man and of the other parts of the universe and of the creation, the only explanation, I think, is that an intelligent spirit put all of this in motion and created us, and we share in his intelligence. Well, let me illustrate it. I'm going to ask you to turn out the lights and let me illustrate it with some slides. I want you to see just exactly what it is that has been created and see if you can explain it without a divine, intelligent creator. We have some slides with the compliments of the Media Center, and we're going to be presenting them to you for your consideration. I don't know, you may not be able to see that back there. Perhaps you can, there's not all that much to see, but that's a picture of a galaxy. This I have taken, and I want to use it just simply as an illustration of matter in motion, matter being propelled through space, matter changing, matter with energy. All of this is true of a galaxy. Where did all this come from? It had to come from somewhere. If it is the origin of life, then perhaps that is the very basis of life. But the question has to be answered, where did matter come from? It's either eternal or it was created. But anyway, I've introduced this series with that presentation there. But look at this mountain. The mountain with green trees and grass, and then below the soil there are probably minerals and other things for man's well-being. Where did this come from, and who designed it and who created it? Or was it just a matter of chance? This beautiful scene of the mountain and the scene of the snow. Where did the snow come from? And did you ever consider the value of the snow? Did you ever consider the beauty of the snow? And did you ever consider the diversity of the design of the snowflake? Someone has estimated that a snowfall of about 6 inches is worth $40 an acre to a farmer. I wonder who devised that means of fertilizing our land. And what was the need for the change of seasons anyway? Why was there the need for a change from this to this? What was the point in it? And who arranged it? Or did it just happen by chance? And who was it, or did it, this also just happen by chance, that the earth would be tilted at just the right angle and would be just the right distance from the sun to not either be burned to a crisp or frozen into an ice block? It's a known fact, and science has proved, that a slight deviation either direction would result in total annihilation of the human race and of the earth itself. Did that just happen? Or was it designed by a very intelligent spirit? Would you please explain to me the beauty of a rose? Would you please explain to me the beauty of the smell of a rose? I think our smelling senses, our olfactory senses, is that right? The sense of smell. Can you explain not only the sense or the fragrance of the rose, can you explain the corresponding faculty in your body that appreciates that scent without someone having made the scent and made your faculty for appreciation of it too? Can you make a rose? Oh, you say, I can make one. Yes, but then make one that will grow. You can't do it. Have you ever seen underneath the sea, those of you who've skin dived or scuba dived or snorkeled, there's a whole new world underneath the water. Beautiful, fantastically rich, and beyond all definition or imagination of man as far as the variety of it. Did that just happen also? Can you make an insect? Would you take whatever it was that this insect is made of, and I suspect you could buy it for less than a penny, maybe not today, but I wouldn't be surprised. Can you make something like this? Would you please put a stinger on him? Would you please put his wings? The aerodynamic design of the body that allows him to get that weight off of the ground and go around doing his business. Would you please design one of those for me? And then would you make him fly? Or did that just happen also? Would you describe for me the gracefulness of a bird and then describe the aerodynamic principles by which the bird flies? Would you also describe for me and define how that in nature, it is so perfectly balanced that all the birds have something to eat, and then the things that the birds eat, they eat what's beneath them. This fish ate a smaller fish, and the smaller fish ate perhaps a smaller species, and then finally they ate the plankton, and then all of this, you see, each feeding on another. Can you explain the balance of nature that would provide food for all of the creation? You see this little critter here? He's one of the little ugly ones that's going to be pretty in a few days. He's just barely born. But would you please look into him, look into his eyes, and look into his ears, and listen to his heart, and explain the miracle of reproduction for me, please? Would you do that within, say, 5 minutes? Could you give the explanation for it, unless it is by design? Tell me how it is that at a certain given time, a signal is transmitted to certain of his glands, and he begins to do things that he didn't do before. Tell me all of these things and then tell me that it just happened by chance. This is a rack of food, vegetables. Would you explain to me the tremendous variety of food that exists in the world tonight? From peanut butter on down, tell me about all the different kinds of food that we have to eat. I guess there would be multiplied thousands of different kinds of food for humans and for other people, other creatures of the creation to eat. Did all this just happen by chance? Did you ever consider the dexterity of the hands? What the hands cannot do, the beauty of them, the utilitarian nature of them, how they are able to work. There's a very interesting story in the book called Tortured for Christ by Richard Wurmbrand, who spent his life in Romania and spent much of his life in prison, some 14 years. In talking with atheists over in Russia, he gave this very interesting story of a man and his wife who were sculptors. And they were sculpturing one day, they said, on a statue of Stalin. And the wife asked the husband, "Husband, have you ever thought about the thumb?" And he said, "The thumb?" She said, "Yes, how it's opposed to the other fingers, and how that without the thumb being opposed to the other fingers, for example, if it were like our toes, you couldn't hold a hammer or a chisel or any other kind of a tool. We couldn't make this statue if our thumb was not opposed to our fingers." She said, "You know, we give honor to Edison and Bell and these other scientists. We praise them for their inventions. But if they had not had a thumb, they would not have been able to invent anything. They wouldn't have been able to hold anything." She said, "I think it reasonable that we also praise the one who made the thumb." She said, "Now, if there is a God in heaven, it is certainly reasonable that he could make a thumb, because God could do anything." But he became very infuriated. He said, "We know that there is no God. We know that there is nobody in heaven." She said, "Then as far as I'm concerned, I will worship the nobody in heaven that made the thumb." And these two atheists finally came to belief in God, that he was not only the maker of the thumb, but he was also the maker of all the rest of the universe. Look at this balancing act and the gentle and sensitive sense of equilibrium that exists not only in human beings, but in lower forms of life also. Look at this soccer game and the agility of the human body. I would have taken one of yesterday's game, but there wasn't all that much agility there. Yet. You'll pardon that. But anyway, I wish I could tell you something about the eye. I don't know all that much about it. I know that it has 3D vision. I know it can see color. I know that it is simply a reflection of what's out there, and it reflects upon the brain. I realize that. But there's a lot of things I don't know about it. I'm going to ask you to show us that other picture that we have back there on the overhead projector. Let me get down to where my intelligence is. I can talk to you about this. I'll have to get on down on my level. Are you aware of the fact that this is just a worm, an earthworm? Are you aware of the fact that an earthworm has all of these things I can't quite see on the other side, but there's the, well, let's get on down here to the esophagus and the aortic arch and the testes and the ovary and the oviduct and the vas deferens and the septum and the dorsal blood vessel and the ventral blood vessel and the nerve cord and the subneural blood vessel and the the nephridium, the funnel of the nephridium, I don't know what that is, the gizzard, the crop, the seminal vesicle. Look at all of this. And all of that's in something that you put on a hook to catch a fish with. I dare say there's not a human being on earth that can stand up to the worm and explain that that just happened by chance. I don't believe that you've got that little sense. I think it would absolutely mean that you weren't reasonable. All right, thank you for that one. And let's look just a bit further over here. Look at this face. Isn't that beautiful? Look at the arrangement of the eyes. Look at the adornment of the hair. Look at the mouth. Look at the ears. Isn't it amazing how that the eyes are there placed together in a beautiful and in a symmetrical arrangement? They are on each side of the nose. The nose has two nostrils. What would you think if one of your eyes normally showed up on one of your big toes and the other eye was sticking in one of your ears? Wouldn't that be that'd be odd, wouldn't it? We would think it odd because we've been accustomed to it being arranged perfectly, giving us 3D vision, giving us stereophonic sound, the ears, giving us the sense of smell, giving us all of these things in such a beautiful way. I just cannot believe that these things happened by chance. This would be more what would have happened had it just been by chance. I don't know what happened to this girl. This was actually just a trick photograph. But to me, and I think any reasonable person would think, this is more likely what would have happened had it just been by chance. It would have been a blob of flesh rather than this. But this is what we have rather than that. I cannot believe that this came just by chance. I believe it must have been designed by an intelligent creator. And I think you would agree. All right, would you call for our lights now and let me draw some conclusions and ask you to do the same. It wouldn't hurt you at a time or at times to sit in the dark and contemplate things like this. I'm going to give one other illustration. My wife nearly fainted when I said I was going to do it, but she's used to things I do, I guess. She thought I was going to dismember this thing up here on the stage. She thought it was going to be a gory exhibition of sadism, but it's not. This doll can be put back together. It's got stumps on its, you know, its little legs. This thing has six parts. Just six. I'm going to demonstrate, and something that you're probably going to think, well, you must think we're imbeciles. No, I don't, but I'm going to illustrate it anyway. I'm going to throw it up in the air, and I'm fully expecting it to come down arranged in its proper order. All right, are you ready? And you're expecting the same thing, I'm sure. Oh, it didn't do it. What a shame. I'm really disappointed. We're trying to arrange for a volunteer group to sit here while we go on and try it again. Surely it was just a slip up, and the next time it'll happen, those six pieces will all come back down in the proper arrangement. Do I have any volunteers that they'll sit here while we conduct that experiment and sit here until it happens? No, I didn't think so. I wonder how many pieces the body has in it. Would you think perhaps that into the thousands it might be that the body has pieces in it, arranged not only like this plastic doll, but with such majestic wonder that you could never begin to describe it or understand it? I wonder how long it would take these things being pitched up into the air, just by chance coming together and all functioning to where we have 3D vision, color vision, stereophonic sound, balance, agility, all of these wonderful things. How long would it take to pitch all that up in the air and have it come down in the right arrangement? But somebody says, I'll bet you that's exactly the way it happened. Really? Then let me ask you one other question. If that be true, who did the pitching? And where did all the parts come from that were pitched? You see, it doesn't make sense. You've got better sense than that. I have too. And I know that it's the only reasonable conclusion that we can come to is that it must have been as a direct result of a design from God. Now, in conclusion, let me give you some quotations. Charles Darwin, when reflecting upon the things that we've shown here tonight, plus a thousand other things that he himself discovered about the universe, makes this statement. When thus reflecting, I feel compelled to look to a first cause having an intelligent mind in some degree analogous to that of man. That's Charles Darwin made that statement. Another quotation, he says, another source of conviction in the existence of God connected with the reason and not the feelings impresses me as having much weight. This follows from the extreme difficulty, or rather impossibility, of conceiving of this immense and wonderful universe, including man, as a result of blind chance or necessity. Darwin says, I can't really come to that conclusion. It just doesn't make sense. It's impossible to conclude that all of this that we've seen and all that he saw was just the result of blind chance or necessity. No, atheism doesn't make sense. Belief in God does make sense. It works, and it's logical. And those two tests, I think, ought to be applied. Did you hear of Isaac Newton? Isaac Newton was a believer in God. He had a friend who was not a believer in God. Mr. Newton, who lived in England, had prepared for him by some mechanical genius a toy mechanical universe. And you've probably heard me or others tell about it. But this thing could be cranked with a crank and the earth would orbit around the sun, and the stars and the moon and all would orbit and all. It was a fantastic arrangement and quite a mechanical invention. This atheistic friend of Mr. Isaacs came by one day, and Mr. Newton was in his study, sitting there reading a book. And his friend walked in, and I guess Newton set him up for it. I can't believe it any other way. He set him up for it, and the man looked at that thing and said this. He said, "My, what an exquisite thing this is. Who made it?" And the record says that without looking up from his book, Newton answered, "Nobody." The friend was a bit taken back, and he said, "Now, who made it?" And Newton said, "Nobody made it." The man blew his fuse. He said, "You think I'm a fool?" He said, "Of course somebody made it, and he's a genius, and I want to know who he is." Well, Mr. Newton closed his book and laid it aside, got up and put his arm on the shoulder of this man and said, "Now, this thing is but a puny imitation of a much grander system whose laws you know. I'm not able to convince you that this mere toy is without designer or maker. Yet you profess to believe that the great original from which the design is taken has come into being without design or maker. Now tell me," Mr. Newton asked him, "by what sort of reasoning do you reach such an incongruous conclusion?" And by the way, about all you could say would be, "Touché." "Very good. He cannot answer. He would not accept that the toy was without designer or maker. And yet, the design and the plans by which the toy was made, this man knew as a scientist. And yet he was trying to claim that the great original was without designer and without maker." Well, in conclusion, may I say this. Mrs. Lynn gave me something the other day she said she thought was interesting. It's not true. But she said it came out in some publication and says this: "To find out what really happened when the earth was created, engineers spent weeks gathering information, checking, rechecking, and feeding it into the computer. The great moment came, everything was complete. Everybody gathered around, a button was pressed, the great computer spun into action, relays opened and closed, lights flashed and bells rang. Finally, the typed message emerged, see Genesis 1:1. That didn't happen. But I'll tell you what did happen. Was it in 1968 or 69 when the three men orbited the moon? What year was it? 69. I forget what it was. An Apollo ship, I believe. But anyway, maybe not. But I don't have my figures on it. But I remember when it happened. And I remember what they came out from behind the moon reading. It wasn't Darwin's Origin of the Species. It was Genesis 1:1. And those men came out reading, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Scientists reading that now. Madeline O'Hare had a floor falling fit. She stomped and raved and kicked. She threatened. She nearly blew a cork. Everything else happened to her. She just went wild. But that's all right. She'll get over it. What she won't get over is her rebellion against God. No, the only reasonable conclusion that a person can come to today is that the earth and all that is in it, man and all that's in him, was created by an intelligent creator, and we were made in his likeness, and we were made for him, and he is our purpose. For in him we live and move and have our being. We're going to sing some songs now. Some songs of praise to God as the creator of the universe. Enter into it with your heart and your soul while we sing together.